Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 210 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, in another instalment of our Poetry Break series, the poets Nicholas Murray and our host Julia Copus discuss two favourite classic poems, To His Coy Mistress by Andrew Marvell and The Sun Rising by John Donne.
This is Poetry Break for the Royal Literary Fund. I'm Julia Copus, and with me today to talk about a particular favourite of his is the poet and biographer Nicholas Murray. Nicholas is a freelance author based in the Welsh Marches and London. He's written 8 collections of poems, 2 novels, and several literary biographies, including A Life of Andrew Marvell, whose work we'll be discussing today. Nicholas was the winner of the 2015 Basil Bunting Prize for Poetry, and his most recent poetry collection is The Museum of Truth, published by Melos in 2017. On top of all this, he finds time to run a small poetry imprint, well known in the poetry world, called Rack Press, and he writes the literary blog Bibliophilic Blogger. With all that going on, Nick, I'm very grateful to you for finding time to talk to me today. I wonder if you could start by telling us which particular poem by Andrew Marvell we'll be discussing today. And then, if you can remember, when it was that you first came across the poem, or what it was that first drew you to it.
Right. Well, the poem I've chosen is To His Coy Mistress. And I discovered this poem at school when I was a sixth former in Liverpool in the early 1970s. And at that time, the metaphysical poets, as they were called, were very much flavour of the month. And there was a Penguin anthology by Helen Gardner called The Metaphysical Poets, which must have, I imagine, sold thousands of copies. And it probably as a result of T.S. Eliot's praise for them, the metaphysicals were definitely in fashion. And I remember when I first read this poem, I was immediately captivated by the wit and the memorable phrasing. Mm. I can still quote chunks of it that I never actually sat down and learned. They just went straight in.
That's always a good sign in a poem, isn't it? If you can remember it without having tried to memorise.
Yes. And it was an actual pleasure to read rather than a sort of classroom duty.
Yes.
And I feel quite strongly about this because people sometimes say, oh, if you do things at school, it puts you off for life. Actually, it had exactly the opposite effect on me. And I suppose, with retrospect, I was lucky in my teachers that they were...
I was going to say, must have had good teachers.
Yeah, that they opened up all these doors
That can make such a difference, can't it? If the teacher is genuinely enthusiastic about what they're presenting to you and they actually like the poem.
Indeed. Having said that, in that anthology, which is a fantastic anthology, some of the other poems were actually quite difficult, more difficult than this one. For example, John Donne. Now, I love John Donne, but he was a harder nut to crack for a teenager.
Yes.
Because of the intricacy of his thought and the complexity of the metaphors, you had to sort of unravel them. Whereas Marvell's poems seem to have much more direct and immediate impact. And it stays that way. And no matter how many times you read it, it's very fresh and witty and pleasurable to read. It never stales.
Okay, well, I've noticed you've used the M word there. M for metaphysical. Both the poets we're looking at today are classed as metaphysical. So later on, we'll discover who that second metaphysical poet is. There wasn't actually ever a group of poets who went around calling themselves the metaphysicals, was there? That was a label that was applied to them afterwards. One of the defining features is their use of what's called conceit. A conceit is basically a comparison between two things that seem at first glance to be really quite different. What these poems do is draw a comparison between those two things and then look at the comparison from various angles in a clever and witty way. And they also often bring in science, Renaissance sort of science and technology. Certainly John Donne, who indeed, you've mentioned.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think the key quality is that they're surprising.
Yes.
And they make you think.
Yes, yes.
Make you think. I mean, for example, he talks about, he uses the phrase, our vegetable love.
Yes.
Now, in a love poem, that's possibly slightly takes you aback.
Yeah.
But what he means simply is, if they had all the time in the world, their love could grow in a slow, gradual, incremental way,
yeah,
like a vegetable.
Yeah.
Also, at the end of the poem, he talks about the two lovers gathering their pleasure like a ball and tearing through the iron gates of life.
Yes.
Now, bearing in mind he was writing at the time of the English Civil War and he was a politician himself.
Ah, so we're thinking cannonball?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, those sort of, you can imagine the Puritan forces firing a cannonball through the elaborate iron gates of,
yes,
a cavalier country house.
Yeah.
That suggestion is there.
I wonder if there's a slight sexual undertone as well.
Yes, probably. Probably, yes. I think that's something that is always present in this poem.
Yeah. A slightly more mundane question. Do we know when the poem was written or when it was first published?
I think that the scholarly consensus seems to be about the end of the 1640s or early 1650s.
Right, so we can't pin a specific year onto it.
I don't think so, no. Mm. I mean, the problem with these poets is that they were often circulated in manuscript. His poems weren't actually published until,
yeah,
after his death in 1681, but they would be passed around. And there were some illicit pirated versions of this poem going around in other people's handwriting with additions. And some of these additions were made as a slightly cruder poem.
Maybe that cannonball image was made slightly more explicit or given a different
absolutely, yes,
timbre. Do you think they would try and keep within metre and rhyme scheme?
Well, the manuscript copies that we can see now indicate, yes, that they would have kept the
right
those rhyming couplets, which, yeah, we'll say perhaps more about in a...
Yes. Yeah, so we're going to go into the poem in a bit more detail in a moment. But first, I think we should listen to it. Before we do that, are there any phrases or words that you would like to either draw our attention to or that might confuse us?
Well, he talks about time and languishing in his slow-chapped power.
Yeah.
I think slow-chapped is a reference to the jaw, the slowly moving jaws of time.
Yes. We now say chops instead of chaps. So yes, he's talking about time here, isn't he? And saying that he doesn't want to languish in time's slow chapped power. So he doesn't want time to chew him to pieces.
Yes, and if you, the whole idea of moving on quickly and seizing the moment.
Mm. Really, if you had to sum the poem up, it's about seizing the moment, isn't it?
Yes.
I noticed that he mentions Humber in line 7. Is that just a random mention? Why Humber in particular?
Well, he was born and brought up in Hull. He was subsequently the Member of Parliament for Hull, so he was rooted in that area, which makes it interesting. It might raise the speculation as whether the coy mistress was actually
a
lass
woman
from Hull.
Yes. Or whether she existed at all, which, again, we will unpick a bit later. OK, well, let's have a listen to the poem now, and it is read by our resident reader, Andrew Stevenson.
To his coy mistress. Had we but world enough and time, this coyness, lady, were no crime. We would sit down and think which way to walk, and pass our long love's day. Thou by the Indian Ganges side shouldst rubies find. I by the tide of Humber would complain. I would love you 10 years before the flood, and you should, if you please, refuse till the conversion of the Jews. My vegetable love would grow vaster than empires and more slow. 100 years should go to praise thine eyes and on thy forehead gaze, 200 to adore each breast, but 30,000 to the rest, an age at least to every part, and the last age should show your heart. for lady, you deserve this state, nor would I love at lower rate. But at my back I always hear time's winged chariot hurrying near, and yonder, all before us, lie deserts of vast eternity. Thy beauty shall no more be found, nor in thy marble vaults shall sound my echoing song. Then worms shall try that long-preserved virginity, and your quaint honour turn to dust, and into ashes all my lust. The grave's a fine and private place, but none, I think, do there embrace. Now, therefore, while the youthful hue sits on thy skin like morning dew, and while thy willing soul transpires at every pore with instant fires, now let us sport us while we may. And now, like amorous birds of prey, rather at once our time devour than languish in his slow-chapped power. Let us roll all our strength and all our sweetness up into one ball, and tear our pleasure with rough strife through the iron gates of life. Thus, though we cannot make our sun stand still, yet we will make him run.
Just hearing it there, it strikes me as quite an ironic tone. He's not overly respectful of the woman that he's addressing, is he? I mean, the mood sort of darkens as the poem goes on.
Yes.
In that middle section, we've got death and decay. He says that there are worms who will crawl into her when she's in the grave. Then worms shall try thy long-preserved virginity. It doesn't seem a very good way to go about seducing someone or persuading them to sleep with you. Is he just addressing a female lover here, or is there something else going on?
Well, a very good question. I mean, some people have wondered whether, in fact, there was such a woman, whether the whole poem is a kind of conceit, if you like. Mm. Some even have suggested, we've touched on the fact already, that he was involved in the politics of the English Civil War. He was an MP, he was famous for having a short temper, and he made a lot of enemies. And there were attacks on him in print, suggesting that he was ambiguous in his sexuality.
Really? Now, this is something I didn't know.
So people might think, well, is this an attempt by him to polish up his heterosexual credentials by representing himself as the great seducer?
Bit of bravado going on.
And I think that's an interesting thought. I mean, if you contrast him with some of the other love poets, his contemporaries, someone like John Donne, for example, one really has a sense that there is a real woman in the poem.
Very much.
Whereas
so.
Here, I mean, we don't hear from her.
We don't get much of a sense of her presence at all, in fact. I think we should consider that female angle a bit further. But first of all, would you mind talking us through the poem very briefly, just in terms of the content? And I think especially in terms of argument, because the argument in a metaphysical poem is central to the whole thing, isn't it?
It is indeed, and it's actually in many ways follows the pattern of a philosophical or a logical argument, a syllogism as it would be called.
Mm.
So it's a witty poem of seduction, and you think initially he's trying to persuade his reluctant or coy mistress that time is flying and they have to seize the moment or it'll be too late. So the first part says, well, if we had all the time in the world, we could spend hours praising your beauty and wait patiently for this vegetable love to swell and grow. But as the second part starts to argue, we don't have that kind of leisure because life is short and the grave beckons. And then the final section, the third section, says that while they are now still fresh and young and full of life, they should make love now in defiance of time and aging. So it looks like an exquisitely formed argument.
Very clear, isn't it?
But we know that it's also a poem of seduction, and is it an argument of good faith, or is it simply tactical?
Is it tactical?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Well, shall we talk a bit about the technical makeup of the poem, rhyme scheme and so on?
Well, I think that what's really interesting about this is that it's probably one of the simplest forms in English poetry, iambic rhyming couplets.
Mm. So we've got, just to explain to listeners what you mean there, so all the way through the poem we've got couplets or two lines that rhyme with each other. Line one, we've got time and then crime. Had we but world enough and time, this coyness lady were no crime. And that continues all the way through. And each line has those four beats in it, doesn't it? It's tetrameter. Mm. So this coyness lady were no crime. Sorry, I've interrupted you, so do carry on.
Well, I'm going to say this maybe is the miracle of the poem, that in a sense, perhaps it ought not to work so well. Because people say, ah, look, this is a steady pattern of rhyming couplets with straightforward rhymes.
Quite artificial.
We should get bored of it, and we're not the least bit bored of it. And I think explanations of that are partly because it's so exquisitely controlled, the meter, the rhythms are perfect. Also, there's a sense of a speaking voice.
Yes.
He somehow manages make the rhythms of ordinary speech work as rhyming couplets. And I think
make it sound quite natural, doesn't
it? Yes. And some of the rhymes, of course, are quite striking. For example, when he says, "The grave's a fine and private place, but none, I think, do there embrace."
Yes.
Now, who would think of embracing in a tomb?
Yeah, right.
So that the effect of surprise is there. And the lightness of touch is wonderful too there.
So there are a couple of other details that I want to pick out here. Line 10 is interesting. "And you should, if we had all this time, you should, if you please, refuse till the conversion of the Jews." I've always assumed it just meant for a very long time, the Jews are never going to convert. But I'm wondering now if there is something more to it.
Well, that makes you perhaps sit up a little. You wouldn't be expecting that. It's been used by Marvel scholars to help with the dating, because at that time, in that great religious and political turmoil of the English Civil War, there were a lot of millenarian religious sects, and there was a general feeling around that the millennium was upon us, and some people even worked out a date for it. They thought it was going to be 1656, when
How
all these things
right.
promised by the Bible, including the conversion of the Jews, would happen.
Right.
And this is why scholars tend to put it pre-1656, the early 1650s maybe. So that's just thrown in a way that I think reminds us of its contemporaneity. This is a poem of a particular moment in English history, although it seems to be not so. It seems to be completely just a love poem between two people. But these little traces throughout the poem are leaving the imprint
clues.
Of the time.
Yes, yes, that's right. And that reference to time's winged chariot. "But at my back I always hear time's winged chariot hurrying near," or "time's winged chariot hurrying near." It's a phrase that works so well that you still hear people using it, don't you? People might not know that it comes from this particular poem. And I suppose it's a reference to the sun god Apollo, who travelled across the skies in his chariot. And that's how the ancients thought the sun rose and fell. But what an amazing image that is.
It is remarkable, yes. And also, as you were saying earlier, the way in which these poets often drew on scientific or cosmological images, we can think of it being literally the winged chariot of myth, but also the sun in its course as well. It's all kind of woven in, isn't it?
There is humour in it.
Yes. I mean, that, for example, the one you just quoted, the "time's winged chariot hurrying near, and yonder all before us lie, deserts of vast eternity." You could say that's sombre, but equally, you could read these lines in a very different way as being playful. And
almost sarcastic.
Yes, and are they really meant, if you take the whole thing as a seduction strategy, then that makes you think that every word in it is false, because it's trickery. Yeah.
Yes, well, seduction is trickery, isn't it?
Mm.
It's interesting to think about the poem in terms of a modern female readership. in terms of its effectiveness as a piece of seduction. How do you think we might react if a male poet presented a poem like this today?
In the era of Me Too.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, I mean, in a sense, this is a male poet, and you're inviting me as a male to comment, perhaps.
Yes.
I should say.
That's why
bring
it's
on the female jury, you know. But much depends on the status that you give this poem. If you think it's a piece of linguistic playfulness, mm. and that perhaps there may not even have been a woman, she may have been an imaginary woman,
mm.
then we can treat it all as a bit of a pleasant diversion. But if there was really a woman there, and he was the kind of arguments that he is using are the old male arguments about stop being resistant, enjoy yourself, don't be uptight, etc., etc., then I can well see that some woman readers, if they really felt this was a serious poem of seduction, might start getting a bit restive.
Mm. My feeling is that there probably isn't a specific woman here. At least I don't get a sense of her, as I've said, in the poem. And that aspect that you've told us about today, the possible male audience who were throwing knives at Marvell, and the fact that he felt a need to defend himself against that and to show his maleness, if you like, really chimes with that feeling of mine that I've always had about this poem, that there isn't a real coy mistress.
Indeed, yes. And there's certainly nothing in it that you would describe as offensive, charms, and so on.
I don't know about that.
But,
about the worms? He's imagining her dead, with worms crawling inside her and trying out her virginity for themselves. If this was written to a particular woman, I could imagine that particular woman taking offence at that image.
Yes, I suppose so, yes. Well, by offence, I meant a kind of violent language or something, but it could well do that. In our discussion about some of the terms that the reader might need alerting to, I should point out that the word your quaint honour. Quaint, some people see as a verbal play on a word which is too indelicate for me to mention in this broadcast.
The other
whether that would, for some people, the mere mention of intimacy of bodily parts and so on itself constitutes an offensive strategy on the part of a male poet. And the whole argument hinges on how seriously we're meant to take it.
Exactly, that's
and
it.
It seems to me that the heart of this poem is a kind of paradox that, I don't know about the woman in question, but it certainly seduces us, the reader.
Mm.
And it does this by never quite convincing us that it is really a serious seduction. And I think that is at the heart of what poetry is about. It's about that element of playfulness, of appearing not to be serious when it's at its most serious. A poem doesn't work if it's just pure content. It has to be self-delighting. It has to be inventive, playful. And because this poem is that, that's why we go on reading it ad infinitum.
Absolutely. Well, I think it's fascinating. Thank you so much, Nick, for talking to us about one of your favourite poems, To His Coy Mistress by Andrew Marvell. So this is a love poem of a very different kind now, although there is an image that connects the two. So your poem ends with the sun, and this poem begins with it. I've chosen to talk about The Sun Rising by John Donne. He was born, in fact, about 50 years before Marvell in 1572, but they are both classed as metaphysical poets for reasons that we've already discussed. So that means that he's going to be using a conceit, that extended metaphor that we've talked about.
And most admirers of Marvell tend to think that he was influenced by Donne very specifically, that the spirit of Donne is there in his work, so he must have been very familiar with it.
Yeah. The speaker in Donne's poem addresses his words not to a mistress, but to the sun, slightly unusually. I think probably we should just hear it before we say anything more. There are a few words for people who haven't heard this poem before. The very first line, unruly, is not the most obvious adjective that you might attach to the sun. It means that the sun is ungovernable and, you know, it won't do as it's told. Unruly sun. And then in line six there, we have prentices, late schoolboys and sour prentices. So prentices is just short for apprentices. And sour here, I think, means resentful. So we've got these young men who are annoyed about having to get up and go to work. Harvest offices in line eight. Call country ants to harvest offices. Offices just means duties here. So he's saying to the son, go and tell the ants to get on with their harvesting duties or doing what ants do. And then in the following line, line nine, climb. And that's C-L-I-M-E, not B at the end of the word. You still hear people as...
climb.
Yes. On holiday to sunnier climes, that sort of thing. And the word climate, of course, is from the same source. So that line, love all alike, no season knows nor clime. So this means something like love is the same all year round. It's all alike. It doesn't have different seasons or climates. Okay, well, I think that's enough for now. Let's just have a listen.
The sun rising. Busy old fool, unruly sun. Why dost thou thus, through windows and through curtains, call on us? Must to thy motions lovers' seasons run? Saucy, pedantic wretch, go chide late schoolboys and sour prentices. Go tell court huntsmen that the king will ride. Call country ants to harvest offices. Love, all alike, no season knows, nor clime. Nor hours, days, months, which are the rags of time. Thy beams, so reverend and strong, why shouldst thou think? I could eclipse and cloud them with a wink, but that I would not lose her sight so long. If her eyes have not blinded thine, look, and tomorrow late, tell me, whether both the Indias of spice and mine be where thou left'st them, or lie here with me. Ask for those kings whom thou saw'st yesterday, and thou shalt hear all here in one bed lay. She's all states and all princes, I. Nothing else is. Princes do but play us. Compared to this, all honours mimic, all wealth alchemy. Thou, son, art half as happy as we, in that the world's contracted thus. Thine age asks ease, and since thy duties be to warm the world, that's done in warming us. Shine here to us, and thou art everywhere. This bed thy centre is, these walls thy sphere.
Although the argument is quite complex, you do get this real sense of passion.
Indeed.
You can see them lying there in bed, can't you, right at the start, when the sun arrives, and him being genuinely annoyed.
Indeed, and the beams are picked up in the second stanza coming through there. And I particularly like that phrase, the last line of the first stanza, where he says, hours, days, months, which are the rags of time.
Mm.
What an interesting word to use. Yeah. It means the insignificant, but rags, isn't it? That's a curious word to use, but it sticks in the mind. And
he could have said fragments of time or, you know, some other word. Yeah. So to pick up on what I was saying about the passion of the poem, in spite of its strong logical backbone, if you like, we have some quite involved analogies going on here. In line seven of that middle stanza where he talks about both the Indias of spice and mine. In other words, the most exotic place on earth. So these are the East and the West Indies. Spice from the East and gold from the West. But what he means is the most exotic and wealthy, gorgeous places on earth. They are not where the sun would have last seen them. They are in bed with him. These arguments are very carefully reasoned. And yet his passion is so apparent, especially in the line, the beginning of the final stanza. She's all states and all princes I, nothing else is. I find that really moving, to feel oneself a prince because of who's lying beside you. And that actual princes appear to be play-acting compared with him. He is the real prince.
And wealth is even bogus. It's just an alchemical
trick.
Nothing is real except their love.
Yes.
And intensified by the drama of this poem, it's one moment. It's just before dawn, in this bed, which is the centre of the universe, these walls, thy sphere. Everything is focused like a spotlight.
I suppose I ought to do what you did and provide a sort of prose summary at this point. So it's in three stanzas. The first begins with insults. So he calls the sun busy old fool. And there's that sense of busy body, the sun poking his nose in where it's not wanted. Then in the second stanza, he starts comparing himself with the sun in a very macho kind of way. Thy beams, so reverend and strong, why shouldst thou think I could eclipse and cloud them with a wink? Unsurprisingly, he comes off best in that comparison. So reverend here, I think, means worthy of being revered. But in fact, he's saying they're nothing. What a great image that is, this huge star that the lover can just disappear with a wink of his eye. But he says, I could do that. I could eclipse them with a wink. But I don't want to lose sight of my beloved for even that split second of time that it would take. So then in the final stanza, he moves on again to make the point that the centre of the universe, the focal point around which everything else revolves, is not the sun. It's where he's lying in bed with his lover. This bed, thy centre is, these walls, thy sphere. So a slightly different argument is being made in each of the three stanzas. So shall we have a look again at the more formal aspects of the poem? Maybe you could say something, Nick, about the differences with the Marvell, formally speaking.
Yes, well, the most obvious formal difference is that it's a more intricate, complicated structure, those three stanzas. So instead of a sequence of regular rhyming couplets, we have a stanza where the rhymes vary throughout, so it's more interesting.
The rhyme scheme is far more varied, yes, but it is repeated exactly the same, isn't it, in each stanza? So for those people who are interested in rhyme schemes and this kind of terminology, the rhyme scheme is A, B, A, B, C, D, C, D, E, E. But that is repeated all the way through and you end with this rhyming couplet.
And the variations of line length too. So there are some, these short lines are very effective. That one that just says, nothing else is, three words.
Yeah, the second lines in each stanza are really short, aren't they? Why dost thou thus? Why shouldst thou think nothing else is?
I said about the Marvell that speech rhythms give it its freshness and livingness. But here I think it's much more like a particular personal voice saying something very direct and passionate. It really feels like someone who's challenging the sun. And you can see this person issuing his defiant call.
Yes, absolutely. So the meter is varied, but again, it's repeated all the way through. With the exception of line 10, which seems to have six beats to the line. So each line in iambic pentameter, ask for those kings whom thou sawst yesterday. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But this line, line 10 of the first, in the first stanza, nor hours, days, months, which are the rags of time. You can hear that dragging out. It seems to be simulating this sort of dragging out of time.
Yes.
So let's just have a look at it in a bit more detail now. Busy old fool, unruly son, why dost thou thus, through windows and through curtains, call on us? Must to thy motions lover's seasons run? And then here, saucy pedantic wretch, go chide late schoolboys and sour apprentices. The emphasis here is on belittling. The son is told to go and call on people arguably less important. There's a little bit of...
I used that word before, arrogance, and I didn't mean it in in the way we normally mean it. What I meant was that way in which lovers claim that they have reduced the universe to the two of them and everyone else can go and take a running jump.
In the second stanza, he reverses the conceit. So he's likened the sun to a person in that first stanza, this busybody figure poking his nose in through the window. And now he compares himself and his lover with the sun. So he turns it on its head. So he says in line 5 of the second stanza, if her eyes have not blinded thine, so the brightness of her eyes outshines that of the sun. And in those lines that you've talked about, I could eclipse and cloud them with a wink. I think the rhythm is really important there because it's such an insistent pentameter that it seems to reinforce the kind of ease with which he might get rid of. I could eclipse and cloud them with a wink. Makes the action he's describing sound very easy. Now, the second half of this final stanza is a little bit complex at first sight. So having been told to buzz off in the first stanza, the sun is now invited to stay. And there's a funny little bit of maths going on here. He says, thou sun art half as happy as we, in that the world's contracted thus. So let's unpick that a little bit. He means, I think, that the whole world is embodied by the two lovers. Nothing else is. So he's saying, you, sun, are only half as happy as we are because we're one entity made up of two bodies and you are just one body. And therefore, we're twice as happy as you are. Something like that, isn't it?
Yes.
And he's talking again about that sense of unity that we get, especially when we're first in love. And to emphasise that unity, there's a change of pronouns. He talked about her eyes in line 5 of the middle stanza. So he's using the third person, and he does in the first stanza too. He talks about late schoolboys and sour apprentices and all these other people who are outside of the magic circle, if you like. And now we change to I and we. She's all states and all princes, I. Thou, son, art half as happy as we. And I think it just emphasises that sense of unity.
Yeah, indeed, yes. It's this idea of consolidation, yes. Mm.
So then in lines 27 to 29 of this 30-line poem, he tells the sun to take it easy because certainly compared to the young lovers, he's getting on a bit. He says, thine age asks ease. And he says he can help out with that because if the sun shines on them, on the lovers, he'll be fulfilling all his duties to warm the whole world. Since thy duties be to warm the world, that's done in warming us because we are the whole world.
Mm. Well, it begins by rebuking the sun and belittling it.
Mm.
But by the conclusion, the sun has been subdued and recruited to them.
What a great
word. To serve their needs because they have, as it were, ingested the sun and it's part of them now. They've defeated
it's a lovely rounding off and a lovely movement, isn't it? From wanting to get rid of the sun to saying, all right, well, come on then.
They began by being vexed and irritated, but they conclude by having total victory.
Yes, with the sun as a little satellite. Well, Nick, thank you so much for coming to Somerset today to talk to us about these poems. It's been really fascinating and really good fun talking to you today.
Thank you very much.
The theme music for this podcast was performed on trumpet by James Copus. Thanks for listening.
That was Nicholas Murray and Julia Copus discussing poems by Andrew Marvell and John Donne. And that concludes episode 210, which was recorded and produced by Julia Copus. Coming up in episode 211, journalist and novelist Amanda Mitchison speaks with John Sadiq about her family's writing legacy, her eccentric newsroom roles in the Vatican and Cairo, the current plight of career journalists, and her wistful links to Scotland. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.